Okay, I'll see you all next week. Thank you. That was filling, very filling. Thank you. And I didn't catch it the first service, but Jackie pulled out a piece of sheet music that looked like an accordion and just laid it flat on top of the piano. I don't know how you did that, but
accordions have a piano on them.
Accordions, yeah. But how did you see it laying like this? It's amazing. Yeah, you can read music when it's flat.
I can read music.
It didn't sound flat. Thank you for singing that again. When was it? It wasn't a month ago because I wasn't here a month ago.
I think it was like 2 months ago.
2 months ago, before I went on a brief sabbatical. Riche performed that, and it just blew me away. Of course, the song was originally written for the 1939 film, The Wizard of Oz. But I felt like I was hearing it anew then and again today. It really had a different meaning for me as a child, hearing it generally only once a year during the film's annual televised broadcast, for those who remember how it was in the old days when there were no videotapes and we could watch whatever we want whenever we wanted. It was sung beautifully, of course, by Judy Garland in her role as Dorothy Gale. And back then it moved me to really dream of that wonderful, wondrous, magical world where I wanted to go and stay forever. Minus, of course, those frightening flying blue monkeys. In more recent years, another version of the song, performed by the late Israel Kamakavivole, I think I'm saying that correctly, made Over the Rainbow the longest leading number one hit ever, and made him Hawaii's most successful musician in its history. And both deservedly so. It too is an incredibly moving rendition, but I personally never liked it. Because for me, it really betrays the meaning of the song, right? It's especially by melding the lyrics with It's a Wonderful World, accompanied by that mellow, carefree sound of the ukulele. The feeling this arouses, at least for me, is more akin to Bobby McFerrin's earlier 1988 hit song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Right? Kamakavivole's 1993 version has that laid-back feeling of ease and commitment, right? Contentment, I should say. But the song itself is about discontentment, about longing to go someplace else, to a better place than the one we're in. And I felt that discontentment and yearning again in Riche's voice a few weeks ago and again this morning. Although unlike Judy Garland's version, I didn't experience it as a wish to go someplace else, but a deeper yearning to transform the very world that we're in. Right? It was a refutation of the way things are and calls us to make things better in a better world. And I feel sadness and disappointment in that song, but also hope and inspiration. For me, the song was no longer about going to a better place, ascending to heaven way up high, removed from the unfairness and pain of our worldly existence. It's not about abandoning our friends and families or our neighbors or our responsibilities or our own potential and purpose in this world, our own agency. It's about sticking around and working to create heaven here on earth. So it made me want to do a better job of making our world what it can and what it should be. What it can and what it should be. That's a big question, isn't it? Do you ever think about that when you look at the way the world is and you think that it'd be almost so easy to make it better? And that was the moment that this sermon was born. And some of you may recall when immediately after their performance, I apologized for removing my smartphone while approaching the pulpit to speak, just to make a quick note. And I wrote down, "Somewhere under the rainbow." Because suddenly that's what the song meant for me. At the end of The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy realizes that things aren't as great over the rainbow as she imagined they would be, and realized that things weren't so bad back home as she once thought either. "There's no place like home," she repeats while clicking her heels together three times before being transported back to her rural Kansas home, surrounded by her loving friends and family. And that's an important lesson. That's an important lesson, too, that the grass always looks greener on the other side of the hill until we get there and we realize it isn't. But today's message isn't about getting a reality check and learning to simply accept our circumstances. It's not about saying, things could be worse. It's about establishing again heaven here on earth. So what does such a world look like to me? Right? That's something I contemplate a lot. What is my dream for us down here under the rainbow? Beneath the clouds and chimney tops, where our troubles don't melt away like lemon drops. Where bluebirds, sometimes happy little bluebirds, still find room to fly. And some of our dreams really do come true. My dream for our world is based on a confluence of ideas that I've learned from those who have most inspired me and shaped my thinking over the years. First among them, as some of you might guess, is... Thank you, Eric Fromm. Yes, thank you. The brilliant 20th century social psychologist who worked not only to show us what the underlying problems down here under the rainbow are, but also to guide us toward their solutions. In short, Fromm believed that our greatest struggles and challenges are rooted in our ongoing anxiety caused by our conflicting needs for both freedom and belonging. To be completely free as individuals almost guarantees that we're going to be rejected by others. Yet to be completely acceptable means giving up some degree of our freedom and our authenticity in order to fit in. The solution to this psychological conundrum is our human capacity to love, according to Fromm, which requires us as individuals and as a society to tolerate our differences out of respect and care for one another. And this attitude, which Fromm calls the biophilious orientation, is grounded in a love for life. But more often, it seems, it's opposite, the necrophilous orientation, grounded in the desire for death and destruction, gets the upper hand, which I believe is the case today and is the reason that so many people gravitate towards authoritarian, narcissistic figures and leaders. They feel both freedom and belonging by mistaking the desires and thoughts of the authority as their very own. That solves the problem. I'm connected to somebody else, and I have my own thoughts and my own will, even though that's a deception. And nobody wants to see themselves in this light. People rather prefer to see themselves as good, independent, heroic figures working in the interest of life, even as they accept the continued suffering of humanity, injustices in the world, and the exploitation and destruction of our planet. In the ultimate act of sublimation, they even call themselves pro-life, although their main focus, as such, is on people who haven't been born, while ignoring the suffering and welfare of those who have. Sublimation is that psychological defense mechanism that transforms destructive impulses into socially acceptable behaviors by redirecting them into what might be considered a positive outlet. In this case, the anti-abortion movement that has been deceptively named pro-life. Right, deceptively, because if we're pro-life, we have to continue that positivity and that concern and that care towards the living, towards those who have been born. And this is where my dream for a better way comes in. Fromm says that we need to create the conditions that would make the growth of humanity, this unfinished and uncompleted being, unique in nature, the supreme goal of all social arrangements. Genuine freedom and independence and the end of all forms of exploitive control are the conditions for mobilizing the love of life, which is the only force that can defeat the love of the dead. To accomplish this, Fromm said, the sole criterion of ethical value must be human welfare, and that the unfolding and growth of every person should be the aim of all social and political activities. Imagine if that was the purpose of everything we do. And don't confuse the humanistic ethic with anthropocentrism. Anthropocentrism is strictly human-focused. The humanistic ethic recognizes that we are part of our environment, and we need that environment and have to care for it. More importantly, in order to fully function and fully develop as human beings, we have to have empathy. And that empathy is expressed for all creatures and even Earth's own systems. So it's not anthropocentric. To care for human welfare is to care for the Earth and to care for other creatures. So this is the starting point of my vision, that this humanistic ethic will become humanity's ethic, so that all we do is rooted in love. Love not as a sentiment, because it's not a sentiment, but as a tangible expression of concern for others by caring for and respecting them and doing what we can and should to assure that everyone, everywhere on the planet, not just 4.3% of them, have what they need, what we need together to thrive and to fully unfold as individuals, even as humanity itself seeks to achieve its own greatest potential. So it's not enough to make America great again, or to put Canada first, as saying I've heard there in recent weeks, or any other country, especially not at the expense of our fellow human beings living elsewhere. The people of South America, the people of Gaza, the people of Ukraine, and on we go. How selfish a thought that we should care for 4.3% of the population. Put them first, make them great. We should be ashamed of those sentiments, especially in today's world. As Will Weissman of Singularity University says, everyone must do well if everyone is ultimately going to do great. And that's how we have to look at the world today. We all need to do well for all of us as a whole to be doing great. And this brings me to another source of personal inspiration, the abundance mindset. The belief as entrepreneur, motivational speaker, and founder of Singularity University and Abundance 360, Peter Diamandis, says that within the next 2 decades, we have the potential to give every man, woman, and child on this planet access to all the education, healthcare, energy, food, and water they want. And yes, this potential will be the result of rapidly emerging technologies, which causes some people to recoil, believing our machines and inventions are what have caused many of the worst problems we're facing today, which they have had a part in, but only because of our own negligence and greed. Yet I have also often noticed that those making this point drive cars and have smartphones and computers, electricity, clean water, toilets, televisions, and all the other common electronic devices and gadgets in their homes, homes that have been constructed from lumber and other materials taken from the earth. Nearly everyone who does live without these modern conveniences today do so because they are poor, not because they wish to. Will Weissman, a believer in the good that technology does and can do, told participants at the 2019 Singularity University Summit, "I'm here because, like so many of you, I believe in my core that an abundant world is possible in the not too distant future, and I want to do everything that I can to help bring that to fruition." To me, he said, that looks like a world where we feed everyone, where we educate everyone, where we shelter everyone, a world where people feel safe and they feel they have a fair shot at living a good life, a world where there are mechanisms to help curb our deficiencies and overcome our most base impulses. I believe in this future, and I believe it will be here faster than many of us think. I also believe that, well, I believe this is so partly because the age of the nation state is coming to a fast end. And to some extent, given the governmental, widespread governmental dysfunction throughout the world, it already has. Governments are failing in their purpose. And this, I believe, is why there is currently a rise of authoritarianism, because too many of us are trying to cling to our nationalistic identities. We see ourselves not as human beings, but as Americans or Canadians or Russians or whatever the case might be. We cling to this identity even though everything about the world that we now live in proves that we are all part of one global community. Nation states don't make sense in this reality. We have a global economy that includes global trade, ports, products, transportation, treaties, corporations, industries, investors, global debt, and as we all know, a global supply chain. We have global challenges like pandemics, war, pollution, climate change. We have global communications, including a World Wide Web, entertainment, news, sports, and celebrities. Thank you, Netflix. We have global science, medicine, satellites, and an international space station. As those in the UK who voted for Brexit not so long ago discovered, and as those in the U.S. who voted for Trump are now learning, it is not possible to turn back the clock and close ourselves off from the rest of the world. We all need to do well for all of us as a whole to be doing great, as Weissman put it. Or as Dr. King more memorably said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. America cannot be great if the other 95.7% of the world isn't. My dream for the near future, down here under the rainbow, is that we will all soon realize that nations no longer serve a purpose and only lead to unnecessary conflict, government gridlock, and incivility. This failure must eventually lead to new and novel ways of meeting our needs and dealing with each other. California, for example, the fifth largest economy in the world, receives billions less in federal funding than the hundreds of billions in federal taxes it pays each year. Oregon and Washington also pay more in taxes, though not as much, than the funding they receive. Together, these states form an economic powerhouse capable of funding their own priorities, from climate initiatives to infrastructure, without federal interference. Silicon Valley's tech dominance, Seattle's global trade networks, and Portland's sustainability initiatives all illustrate the potential of regional leadership. By forging direct partnerships with other nations, or city-states, to be precise, including those in other countries, this Cascadia corridor that we're in could even participate in global trade agreements, climate pacts, and technology-sharing initiatives. Such alliances would position coalition states as key players on the world stage, not just on the national stage, independent of federal constraints. And critics might argue that withholding federal taxes would deepen our national divisions, accelerating fragmentation in the United States. But if it's already divided, fragmented, and failing, which I would say it is, then this is a moot point. There's also an ethical imperative to act, particularly on existential threats like climate change. We can't wait. We can't wait for the federal government to get its act together. Federal dysfunction has left millions of Americans vulnerable to environmental disasters, economic inequality, and the erosion of our civil liberties. The GOP, in particular, has denied and ignored climate change for decades. For decades, yet President Trump is now blaming California itself for its unprecedented lack of water and number of fires that such negligence has led to. So rather than being left to the whims of POTUS, states like California, Oregon, and Washington, with the resources and vision to lead, should step forward, not as secessionists, but as innovators, especially as the age of the nation state continues to wane. Now, this is a suggestion we could get on top of, but I also believe it's inevitable. Because as one system fails, we have to put other systems in place that get the job done. And that's the path I see forward. Yet another inspiration in my life is my college philosophy professor, Dr. Wallace Roark. Some of you heard me talk about him in the past, who taught me a lot about thinking, including logic. And he often cited the Greek particles men, de, which translates while on the one hand, but de on the other hand. And in his attempt to teach his students how to become better thinkers, he taught us to always consider ideas that are contrary or even contradictory to other ideas, especially to our own ideas. After he retired, Dr. Roark wrote a book on logic entitled Think Like an Octopus. On the one hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, And so on, it never ends. Dr. Roark's dream for his students, his dream for me, has become my dream for the whole of humanity, that we become better thinkers. I'm often saddened, frustrated even, that with all of our scientific advances and increased understanding of the world and the human condition, humanity by and large still clings to ancient superstitions, readily embraces baseless conspiracy theories, engages in anti-science and obvious logical fallacies without shame or awareness, and is more often guided by emotions than sound reason. This is even true of many liberals I know who are supposed to embrace reason. That's supposed to be a defining quality of what it means to be liberal. Many, many of them, based upon the false dichotomy of feelings and reason, that they're antitheses of each other, argue that those who use reason and logic must therefore be out of touch with their feelings. I consider this nonsense. Unless one is a complete sociopath, right? We are all fundamentally emotional thinkers. Feelings come natural to us, logic doesn't. This is because the emotional layers of our brain, right, are much more ancient, established, and therefore autonomic and more powerful. They have more control over us. But thinking, reason, happens in the neocortex, the new part of the brain that is not autonomic or is powerful an influence in our lives. It's also the part of the brain that uses the most energy. So we tend to rely on less energy-intensive instincts, feelings, and heuristics than to take the time to rationally think things through. Like we're mostly on autopilot. As psychologist Daniel Kahneman suggests in his book, we tend to think fast, not slow. Being logical doesn't mean, however, that we don't have feelings. Nor, if you stop to think about it, if that is, you think slowly about it, you'll probably agree that the problem with the world today isn't that humanity is too rational. It's not that we think too well and feel too little. So my dream for the near future is that people across the board become better thinkers, especially by avoiding obvious fallacies and by becoming less fearful of entertaining new ideas, including especially those that we might disagree with. There's a lot of anxiety about artificial intelligence, some of it justified, some not. But I have much hope for how AI can help my dream come true. As with all technologies, it can be used good for good or ill. But as with all tools, it is meant to assist us in our efforts. In Harvard Business Review's The Year in Tech 2025, there's general agreement that AI will take over some of the mundane jobs that humans now perform, but this will mostly free human workers to concentrate on more important tasks, not replace them. The review says, in 2025, companies must evolve and change to become more human AIized in their own way, embracing and adapting to the fusion of humans and machines. Good leaders will inspire their people to understand and embrace this new form of collaboration. Right? The assembly line that people thought was going to take away jobs made more jobs because it freed people to do more. Focusing on such collaboration, not only in the workplace, but in government, in governance, is also the point of the new book, Genesis, Artificial Intelligence, Hope, and the Human Spirit, written by the great polymath and statesman, the now late Henry Kissinger. His final gift to us, along with his co-authors Eric Schmidt and Craig Mundy. Even the wisest leaders, they remind us, propelled by instinct and tempered by caution, sometimes govern on the basis of fleeting passions. Although AI should not make decisions for us, it can be used to help us see past our biases and faulty reasoning to make better decisions. AI's value in governance, so far dormant, they write, lies in its potentially perfect knowledge. This is the same advantage for all of us. Just try it sometime. If you're writing something, drop it into AI and ask it to look for fallacies, logical fallacies. Ooh, that's uncomfortable. By collaborating with AI, we can become better thinkers by making more rational decisions. So I hope this is the beginning of a new age, not only of machine intelligence, but of human intelligence and reason. Finally, my dream for us down here under the rainbow is that all the advances that I've imagined so far, the widespread adoption of the humanistic ethic, making human welfare and individual unfolding the purpose of everything we do, creating regional and global city-state coalitions that better meet our needs and address our greatest challenges as one unified global community, one unified global species, and becoming better thinkers who are less swayed by our own emotional biases and faulty reasoning, let alone the primitive beliefs and instincts and fears that prevent us from achieving our full human potential, will ultimately lead to much greater peace and civility in our communities and throughout the world. The humanistic ethic naturally will guide us towards doing this, doing what is best for humanity and the individual, which should result in a more civil society in which we treat those that we disagree with respectfully, setting aside our differences to work together toward our common goals and to address our common challenges. Likewise, by establishing global collaboration between the world's megacities, we will eventually shun our outdated nationalistic identities and recognize ourselves for what we really are, one human species. Instead of relying on varying degrees of human rights from country to country, those coalitions can insist that all partners adhere to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights already agreed upon by numerous countries. And this more peaceful and civil society can be further fostered by using AI to help us think like an octopus. What are we missing? What am I missing? Right, it's the unification of our knowledge that we can tap into anytime and say, what am I missing? What am I getting wrong? Powerful tool. Instead of social media platforms, using algorithms that only present us with more extreme examples of the ideas we've already been watching or seen, social media companies, having made human welfare and individual growth their main priority, can create AI-driven algorithms that present us with opposing views. Imagine that. It's been done before. Back in the day when our school still taught civics, the U.S. had a rule in place called the Fairness Doctrine. Some of you remember that broadcast media had to present opposing sides of an argument in order to remain licensed. That was a goal, that was a value. So as with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the civics courses are still there, even if we've not been using them, along with rules that we know can work. We just have to start using them again and abiding by them. Today we stand not only under the rainbow, but on the precipice of a great transformation, Rather than yearning for escape, let us commit ourselves to making a better reality. Imagine what can happen when we fully embrace our humanistic ethic of love and respect. When we forge innovative coalitions that transcend borders. And when we harness technology and reason as allies in our pursuit of our highest aspirations. Together, guided by our profound interconnectedness and a vision of abundant possibilities, we can indeed build a world worthy of our most heartfelt dreams. A world in which compassion triumphs over fear, wisdom prevails over ignorance, and humanity truly blossoms into the best version of itself. So let us be visionaries and builders of that brighter, kinder, more inclusive world, because in the end, there is truly no place like home. Thank you.